Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special post-Oscars edition of Real Blend, a podcast that, if I'm being totally honest, is feeling a little bit guilty about speaking that Green Book Best Picture win into existence.
Hey, only one of us, Sean, spoke the Green Book win into existence, O'Connell. Hold that guilt all to yourself.
It's all your fault, man.
It's fully on me. My name is Sean O'Connell, and I'm the man responsible for Green Book winning Best Picture at the 91st Academy Awards.
Happy with yourself.
I'm also the managing director here at Cinema Blend and one third of Real Blend. And guys, I'm exhausted today. Like, the day after Oscars telecast is physically and mentally draining. But first, before we kick in, we're going to go through the entire telecast and strictly keep it to a rundown of everything that we learned at the Oscars last night. I have to introduce my boys, see how they're doing, starting with Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. How are you, sir?
Dude, I'm tired, man. I'm tired. This is there was just this feeling today of and because I'm sure Kevin was too. I was on my morning show and recapping the Oscars, and just this feeling of like we just finished a marathon. And the marathon started in September. And just this moment of like, we're done. And now I'm tired because I don't have to see fake Glenn Close's like little like, oh, who me? Like acceptance like look anymore.
How stunned do you think Glenn Close was?
That was the best performance of her career, pretending to be happy for Olivia Colman.
Wow. Yeah. All right. We're going to get to that first. Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Kevin, do you feel the sense of the end of the marathon also?
Yeah. And I was talking to someone about this today, and I find it interesting that every year, I feel like I have the Redskins here in Washington, D.C., and every year they just disappoint beyond belief. But there's this like glimmer of hope sometimes that something will happen, that they'll change their tune. There were things that happened this year, and we'll get to the telecast, that I did really like, and I think we're moving in a better direction. But after that Best Picture announcement last night, I woke up this morning and I'm like, why do I somehow think they're going to fix this every year? And then they go with the movie that no one is going to remember, that no one's going to talk about, and that it had absolutely no change on cinema. I mean, I just don't understand. Like, that was the worst choice of the eight to go with. Maybe Vice, I don't know. So, I don't know
what I also found really strange? And we're going to be sort of, this is going to be ADD podcasting, because I think as things come to mind about the show, we're going to want to touch on them. Gabe is already...
I already got wrapped. 2 minutes into the show.
Unlike the winners for Best Makeup, you got wrapped very early.
When Peter Farrelly...
For the record, I got wrapped 2 minutes into the show today.
...was on the stage for Best Picture... Did you guys find it really awkward where he was like, this whole movie is about Vigo?
Yes.
Not Don Shirley. He said it began with Vigo. Didn't begin with Dr. Don Shirley. It began.
And then he was kind of like, and Mahershala too, but really it's Vigo. And I was like,
that as like, oh, we feel kind of bad because this entire award season, Vigo hasn't really won anything. And I feel like he hasn't gotten to have, he thought that Vigo hasn't gotten to have his moment. That was a poor way to phrase it.
Can we also talk about the idea that this movie, we don't know for sure, I'm not saying this is 100%, but it probably won because of this preferential ballot system. I would imagine that, do you see a lot of people, Sean, in the Academy putting Green Book at number one on their Best Picture list, or do you think it won because of the preferential ballot system that allows it to win in 2 and 3?
I would 100% put it the preferential ballot system.
So it goes to 100%. The movie that's like just universally accepted.
Yes, I think so. All right, well, we will get into all of this because we're going to cover every single aspect of the Oscar telecast. This will be our big wrap-up for the 91st Academy Awards. As everybody knows, we kind of started as an Awards Blend podcast. This is our second time going through the Oscars, but we're going to try to do as traditional a show as possible, which means that we begin with reviews, and we have three of them to begin with. First one is by Tom Tinney, who is a frequent contributor on Twitter and in the Real Blend community, a huge diehard fan as well, too. He's a good friend of mine from back in the day.
With a vengeance.
He loves With a Vengeance.
Good. Yeah. Thank you.
He says, Real Blend is a must-listen-to film podcast. There are many podcasts out there about film, but not all will get me to hit that subscribe button. But Real Blend hosts Sean, Jake, Kevin, and their producer Gabe did just that. Each week, the Real Blend team deep dives into the film world, delivering knowledgeable news from the industry, reviews, and debate. They consistently bring energy and passion in a mostly professional way. That creates one hell of a listen each week.
What do you mean, every mostly episode, professional?
I mean, he put that in parentheses, but it's there. So it's very clearly, we're not 100% professional.
Maybe that's me screaming, you assholes, in the last episode.
He did swear a lot.
I did.
Every episode celebrates films of past and present with engaging topics like no other. Highly recommended, Dunkirk.
No.
Yes.
I mean, I'm so proud of our listeners that they end reviews with Dunkirk. By the way, and that review obviously mentions Gabe's. That was clearly Gabe's mom, right? Yes. I mean, that was definitely a Gabe's mom review.
The implication being that your mom doesn't like Gabe?
No, she loves Gabe, but I think Gabe's mom wrote that review. Gabe's mom, by the way, legally, her name is Gabe's mom.
Gabe's mom. This one comes from M.A. Sheets. It says, one of the best. It says, this has quickly become one of my favorite podcasts. The passion these guys have for movies is clearly evident, and they have outstanding chemistry that isn't easily replicated. The fact that they are also industry insiders who get to talk to those actors and filmmakers we love is an added bonus. In fact, this is one of the podcasts that inspired me and my friend Adam to start our own entertainment podcast called Screen Time. Hey, we're plugging Screen Time for you. There you go, Adam. Congratulations. We're 5 episodes in. Thanks again, guys. Can't wait for the next episode. P.S. Kevin is right about First Man. Dunkirk in all caps with an exclamation point.
I also like First Man.
Yeah.
Apparently that was written by Damien Chazelle's mom.
Do you think it should have won VFX Oscars over Infinity War and Ready Player One?
Look, you're getting the wrap. We haven't even started. We're getting the wrap already. Oh, Gabe's gonna pull his hair out by the end.
So angry. That's the one I'm most furious about.
We've been wrapped 5 times. Just a heads up. We're only 7 minutes into the show.
This one's gonna be off the rails.
Yeah.
This one came via email, via the Real Blend email. And that's right. If you're not on iTunes and you would still like to send us a message, you can send it to realblend@cinemablend.com. And this comes from Baldvin, and this man is in Sweden. He said, I come from Iceland, where the quote-unquote going to the movies culture is very strong, so it is kind of in my blood. After I moved to Sweden with my family, I kind of backed off for a few months until I discovered Cinema Blend, which led me to the Real Blend podcast, and this show has brought me back. I enjoy your talk in every way, and the fact that you let us in makes this more special. Being a blender is such a joy, and it is all because we share one thing in common, love for movies. Thanks, guys. Baldvin. And he says, P.S., can you bring back Facebook Live maybe once a month? And I think that's a great suggestion.
Yeah, so what we're going to do with that is we'll just have Gabe log on once a month for an hour. And you can just talk with Gabe.
Just watch Gabe.
From literally, Sweden. Gabe will just wrap you up in every question you have. And that's it.
There we go. So those are our reviews. If you guys want to hop on iTunes, send us a new review. You know we appreciate it. If you're not on iTunes and you want to email it to us, realblend@cinemablend.com. Gabe says, don't reveal what you can tease. We're working on. Oh, I can't. That's right.
I'm pretty sure you weren't
right. I can't.
That out loud.
I can't reveal that. That was in red, so it stood out, and it said, don't do this. So I can't tell you guys anything, but we might be working on a video element. Oh, that's what, all right. We might be working on a video element for the show if we can hammer out the specifics of how to pull it off. Is that fair, Gabe? Is that right? That's good. Oh, we also have, I don't know, can I talk about the merchandise? Do we have merchandise? There's merchandise. That's happening.
Why am I hearing about this stuff for the first time on the show?
Live.
Because the people who need to know know. That's what it is. The people who are in the know.
So
you do know.
Just...
You saw it. You saw a picture of it.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I know what he's referring
yeah.
to. Okay.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. So anyway, that's for later. We
Ooh,
have one thing
yeah,
that
those.
We have to talk about. Oh, now Gabe's showing off the merchandise. Yeah. We have one thing that we do need to talk about before we dive into the Oscar telecast, and it is the trailer, kind of, that was shown during the telecast, the Oscars telecast last night, for what I have to believe is the most anticipated movie for Real Blend in 2019. Although Kevin put it next to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This is for Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. This was a teaser that basically listed Scorsese's name, the title of the movie, and then the cast, which would include Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Harvey Keitel, Joe Pesci.
Hey, do you know what all four of those guys have in common? They have an I in their name.
They do. And the I was formed by a bullet shell casing. And some dialogue. There was some dialogue between Pacino and De Niro, which meant nothing to me. But even at that, I was electrified by the trailer. What did you guys think?
Did it really make you more? I mean, I was already excited about this movie. I get that that's what a teaser is. I understand the concept and that we're super far out and that that's probably as good as it's going to get for the time being. But it didn't make me any more excited about the movie than I already was. It was a cool idea that with the gun, with the bullet casing sort of falling and it forming the eye in everyone's name. Like, it's cool. But I didn't, like, it's a 48-second trailer, and after the 48 seconds, it wasn't like, well, now I'm more excited. I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Like, it's an acknowledgement that it exists. I did like, however, and in the spirit of Kevin McCarthy, before it said Netflix, it said in theaters.
Yes. And here's the one thing I'll say about that trailer. Not everybody has the insight we do into the movie business. Like, not everybody knows there's a new Martin Scorsese film coming out with everybody in this movie. So now there's two ways to look at this. One, I thought the trailer was great. I like things like that. I like a little tease, they're giving us something. We've seen nothing.
Wouldn't
on this
you
movie.
Like it to, like to end with just a quick glimpse of what one of the guys is going to look like?
Sure. Definitely.
That's fine. But I mean, I thought the bullet was really clever. I thought that was fun to watch. I was completely, I don't know. I didn't expect the trailer. So it wasn't like I was just surprised by it and I was happy with it. But, you know, not everybody watching that show last night knew that Martin Scorsese had a new movie coming out with all those people in it. So maybe they learned it last night based on that.
And we don't know when it's coming, right?
Well, it said fall,
I'd
right?
Read
Did
October.
It say fall?
Okay.
Because
yeah, that makes sense.
It's weird. I actually put that in my top 10 most anticipated movies of 2019. But then I started getting worried it was going to get pushed to 2020. Because there was no, like, official release date for it. But he's done shooting it, right?
I believe so, but most of it is just the de-aging process, which I know you were talking a bit about with Sam Jackson, and I the characters in this movie, from what I understand, are going to span decades, and it's going to be the same actors doing it. So I think it's just so awesome. Much post-production.
Yeah, the de-aging on Sam Jackson, when you guys see Captain Marvel, it's that we've made it. We've gotten to a point where you can do it and right. do it flawlessly and do it for a character who's on screen for a long time. So right. if anything, Captain Marvel should give people an excitement level for what they're going to do with Irishman, specifically considering how much the budget was, right? Didn't they give Scorsese
like
a
175
budget?
I think that's
huge.
The big reason he left Paramount, because no other major studio was willing to drop that kind of coin for him.
Why
and he knew
is
he
that
needed
film
that.
Cost that much, though?
It's
it
all
the
de-aging,
man. Things?
I mean, if it's a three-hour wow. movie and you've got to de-age four yeah. major actors for, from what I've read, half the movie, so we're talking like an hour and a half, I mean, that's a lot of money, dude.
Forgive my ignorance. I have not read into a lot of what this film is about. Why? What is it about and why are we
spanning
all
these decades?
There's
something about that line about painting houses. Is from what I, because I looked this up whenever they first announced who, like, and I looked up to who the guy was. That line about, I hear you paint houses, is pretty substantial. I can't remember exactly the details, but that there's a reason they put that line in the trailer. I read the Wikipedia
page on
the guy.
De Niro, Pacino, Keitel, Pesci. Yeah. It's those four. Yeah. And they're all going to be.
Pacino's the only
and
one
Ray
that
Romano.
Has it. All right. It's an Irishman. I can't do it.
It's the story of the guy who allegedly killed Jimmy Hoffa. I mean, okay. That's the big hook. And Jake's right. There's something to do with house painting, which is kind of like what the guy's front was.
That's what. Yeah, I think that was what he told. And that's why when he was like, "I hear you painted houses," and he just goes, "Yeah,
yeah."
Well, I was home this weekend and I was going through I think Netflix or something and I found The Departed and I put that on for like an hour and a half. That film. Should not work as good as it does. It's so good, and it's
it doesn't.
So, but it's Aww. So ADD. Oh, I love The Departed.
You a cough?
But it is, it's truly an ADD film. Like, that film is just...
I mean, doesn't it take like 30 minutes before we get the title card?
Oh, yeah. And it's like, but it's so good.
Oh, I love it. I love The Departed.
Like, you'll be in the middle of these really heavy dialogue sequences, and then he'll jump to like a Rolling Stones track, and it'll be a montage. And for some reason, it works.
Like, see, I mean, now that's why I argue it feels to me like a hack director trying to do Scorsese.
I didn't find that. I mean, I don't think he deserved to win finally for that. I think he deserved to win like way earlier for like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, things like that. It was a make good Oscar, and The Departed's I think Departed's a great movie. Don't get me wrong. I still think the Martin Sheen death in that scene, that movie, is so brutal. That, oh my God, that fall, and that, yeah, oh, but the
Sean,
sound.
Sean's right, and I love The Departed. In fact, I think it was my number one of the year it came out. But it is Scorsese almost knowingly doing Scorsese.
Yeah. But I mean, like, even Wolf of Wall Street had that ADD element where it was like, but Wolf of Wall Street
seems tighter.
It's still my favorite DiCaprio performance of all time. Such a great movie. Anyway, so, but yeah, I think The Irishman looks cool. I definitely want to see it in theaters. And, you know, props to Netflix for doing this. They're doing this with a lot. The Triple Frontier, by the way. The movie that Jake and I are going to New York to cover this week with Ben Affleck and Charlie Hunnam. I believe that comes out a week before Netflix in theaters. I think they're doing a theater release.
So does that clear them with AMC? Because that was AMC's big hangup, which was it's gonna be 90 days. No.
AMC and Regal want 90 days.
Although you're never gonna get 90 days from Netflix.
I know.
But I think Irishman is gonna be very telling because Irishman is gonna be the first. I mean, they could almost arguably get by not putting Roma in their theaters because probably they're thinking no one's probably gonna go see Roma in theaters. Are they seriously not gonna put a Scorsese movie with Pacino and De Niro and Pesci and Keitel in their theaters? AMC.
Well, here's the thing. I'm sorry. I think
Irishman is what is going to get Regal and AMC to cave because they're going to want that in theaters.
I don't think they're going to cave, and here's why. Like, I think a lot of people, and here's the thing, we all build an excitement for a release date. There are people out there in the world, a lot of people, who don't consider theatrical to be the day the movie comes out for them. It's the day the movie comes out on demand or digital. They live their life in that cycle.
That sounds horrible.
So the theatrical I know, but some people do. But my point being is that, and this is a question that I think is very fascinating, if you are given a movie in theaters a week before it hits Netflix, will you wait that week to watch it on your subscription and not spend money to go to a theater? Or will you go to a theater?
Are you talking to me or are you talking to the average person that has Netflix?
The average person who has Netflix. So,
oh, they'll wait.
I mean, me. Right. So my point being is like, why would AMC and Regal cave for only a week span? So I think what they'll do is they'll do the same thing they did with Bird Box and Roma and all these movies. They'll put it into the Landmarks, the IFCs, whatever theaters that Netflix is being connected to. And then you'll go right to Netflix with it. I mean, here's the thing. I'm okay with it because we're still getting the theatrical window prior to the release of the Netflix movie. That's all I care about. That's all that matters to me. So I'm okay with that.
Fascinating. All right, let's get to the Oscars. Sunday night was the Oscar telecast. And right off the bat, I want to comment on the fact that they had no host. And people weren't sure if that was going to be a train wreck or if this was going to be the sign of things to come. And I want to go first and just say that to me, it was a great choice. I think it showed that they weren't necessarily ready for it in terms of the telecast, because the telecast had a bunch of hiccups where like winners would end up on stage in a big group and they didn't know how to transition to the presenter next. But it was fine. I was okay with that mess because what I found was they open with Queen and then they start giving out awards right away. So by the 8:30 mark, I think we had 6 awards given out. And I was like, this thing is flying by, you know, like normally in your head, you get to a benchmark where you're like, oh, now we have a couple of winners. It must be 9:15 or something. And it was only 8:30. And I thought that the whole thing was humming. Did you guys like the lack of a host? Or did you ever at one point think, oh, I wish we had somebody to come on and sort of help transition things along?
I missed the host, if I'm being honest.
Really?
I missed the opening monologue. I missed the through line. I missed the immediate reaction to certain moments. At a certain point, it felt a little like step and repeat. It was presentation, winner, speech, presentation, winner, speech. And yeah, you're right. It absolutely buzzed along. And there was a moment where I looked at the clock and thought, damn, we're an hour and a half in and we're halfway through. Like, this thing's going to clock in under 3 hours. And that was great. But I would say, give me another 30 minutes tacked onto the show and then give me all the bits. And I'm not saying that we need, you know, I think unfortunately lately the host means Jimmy Kimmel going into the movie theater next door in a bit that just goes on forever and just doesn't really have any payoff. I'm not saying we need to go that far, but like Ellen walking through the aisle taking selfies with people, Ellen walking through the aisle giving candy to Martin Scorsese and Clint Eastwood, those little moments, that through line that kind of strings each award together, I would say I miss that. Because other
now, why can't they have that, though? Can't they do that anyway? Like, it doesn't have to be an official host, but could they do bits with the people in the crowd?
Why, you know, why go that close and then not have a host? If you're going to do it, just do it and have it be one person.
Because I'll say this one thing. Today I watched the monologue that Aubrey Plaza gave for the Indie Spirit Awards.
Right? That was good.
And it's a funny monologue,
it's
right?
Very
but as
good.
I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, but this is kind of I don't necessarily need this stand-up routine, you know, from a celebrity. I did think it was funny, but now that I've seen the Oscars without the tacked on monologue, I didn't need it. Kevin, where are you?
I am all in on no host.
Really? That surprises me.
And it sounds weird because that you would think that I'd want the old school nostalgia way of the Oscars. I thought last night's show was moving and it was entertaining.
But what was memorable about it?
What was memorable? I mean, I can go through a list. Are we going to get through everything? I mean, there's a lot of things that were memorable.
But like in 10 years, what was memorable about that show?
Gaga Cooper.
Okay, but that had the host that had no impact. The host had no impact.
That's still the show, though.
I prefer, now you can't do this every year, but I preferred the Queen opening to
me
a
too. Here's the thing.
We'll get Elton John next year.
The ratings are, which is awesome. The ratings are up, clearly. And the last number I looked at was, I believe, 13 to 15% from last year. Again, they're coming off a bad year, yes.
Yeah,
but
it's still, yes. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. Like, yes, they're up, but they're up from the lowest and they're still the second lowest.
Well, there's two reasons why they're up. They're up because I think the show was tighter and it was more entertaining, and it was up also because a lot of films that were nominated were films that everybody in the world saw. So like Black Panther, Bohemian Rhapsody, Star is Born were very big films for a lot of people. So clearly people wanted to tune in to see if their movie was going to win. Going back to the host thing, I loved Ellen. I mean, what you're saying about Ellen was amazing. I didn't miss the host last night. I thought that the presenters provided that through line for me in regards to the entertainment. I loved Maya Rudolph and Tina Fey and Amy Poehler doing the "We're Not the Hosts" bit
Very
and then
funny.
Just doing a joke. I thought opening with the musical number was super strong. Javier Bardem was rocking out. It was actually really cool to see people in the crowd rocking out. I don't know. To me, the show was just... I had the same thing. We're an hour and a half in. I was like, blew my mind how fast this thing went by. And every category got recognition. And every speech, for the most part, was great. So I just loved the entirety of the show. My favorite thing about that show last night was the way they transitioned to Cooper and Gaga. There was no introduction. Zero someone saying, here's Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga. The guy got off stage for winning an award. They cut backstage. It's one single shot on a Steadicam going up to the piano. I love the behind the scenes people bringing the piano
these
out.
These are all improvements in producing and writing.
Right.
These are not improvements that were made because there was no host.
Well, see, now if there was a host.
These are all things that could be better with a host.
I disagree. Like,
all that requires is the producer to get more creative.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have had a host, but still had Cooper and Gaga emerge from the crowd. You could have had a host and still had the presenters have funny bits. I mean, they've tried funny bits in the past. They've just fallen short. That's all writing and producing. That has nothing to do with whether or not they had a host.
Let me ask you this, though.
The only thing that was impacted by not having a host was the speed in which the show moved.
Yeah, and it was awesome. I mean, the show moved briskly.
Why does the show have to be fast?
No, but the show was 3 hours and 15 minutes.
We get this once a year.
Because you feel a drag. Don't you feel a drag some years?
Also,
even though I'm enjoying it, I still think, like, you know, okay, come on, this is... But I'll tell you the one thing that I thought needs to go, and this is the red carpet coverage. The red carpet coverage
is
internal.
That's not part of the show. Yeah, that's not part of the show.
You know what?
Though.
There are a lot of people that aren't on this podcast that's what they tune in for.
That's all they want.
They tune out when the show starts.
Yeah. Well, I'll say one thing about the show itself specifically is the fast pace of element of it. And the production wise, I thought it was well shot, and I thought it was.
Aside from the Gaga. Performance. I thought it was actually weirdly shot. I thought it was actually
didn't bother me.
It was there were a couple of moments where I thought, "What are they doing?" The producer.
I had a friend, a guy who does morning radio here in Charlotte, who was having me on this morning, and he texted me before he was crashing last night at like 9, and he said, "Is it just me or is this a train wreck?" And I was like, "No, I think it's actually great." So I mean, it's pretty funny. The opinions are kind of all over the place in terms of how it was perceived.
Jake, let me ask you this, and I want you to be 100% honest, which you always are. How many times have you watched the Academy Awards and then they bring the host back an hour and a half into the show and you go, "Oh, I forgot he was hosting." Happens to me every year. I'm like, there's Kimmel. Oh, there's.
I mean,
there.
But that's that goes back to the produce the show better, or the argument being that they did bits that fell flat that you don't remember. Like, but essentially, what I'm asking for is to bring the host back, but step up your game. Like, if all you can offer me is Kimmel going next door and surprising people in a movie theater and having that bit go on, like, if your bit has to go to commercial break and come back to complete it, then it's not a good bit.
But they,
bring in people off the streets and having them, like, be married, like, live. Like, I don't want that. But I loved, like, the selfie, you know. Like,
yeah, that was great.
That's the sort of stuff that I like. So, you know, like, Scan, you've got 91 years of the Oscars to look back on and figure out what worked and what didn't. But you know, for you know, 89 of those years, there have been hosts, or however many years since they've had a host, and a lot of times it's worked. More often than not, it has.
Like the Ellen hosting was amazing. That's one you keep going back to. That's the only one you keep going back to.
I'm trying to think of, like, lately, because, you know, it's easy to go to Billy Crystal and Whoopi Goldberg, but, like, they're probably not going to do it again. And a lot of the stuff that they did probably maybe won't fly. But, you know, I was watching one of Billy Crystal's entrances. From the early 90s, and it was when Silence of the Lambs came out, and he came out, you know, and on the upright gurney with the Hannibal Lecter mask, and came out and, like, made a joke and then started the show. Yeah. I'm not saying it's got to be this big razzle dazzle, but, like, someone to just kind of pop along and kind of keep the show moving, and then if something weird happens or something funny happens in an acceptance speech, then we cut back to this person and see what are they going to say, how are they going to react to that, and I just missed that. It felt a little step and repeat. It didn't feel like it really had a heart or a soul to it.
I thought the show had a great energy. It never lost me. I've felt these shows drag, and I'm the biggest. We're all big movie fans, and it drags. Like, not even a moment. Not even during the documentary short speeches. I was all into it. The whole thing I was into.
All right. Well, let's get to.
But I get where Jake's coming from. Like, there have been hosts that have done a great job. But last night's show was one of the best Oscars I've seen in a long time.
Refraining from talking about Best Picture, because we'll save Best Picture for a conversation a little bit later on in the show. I guess let's start with what was your favorite win last night? What's the win that got you guys most excited?
Ooh, that's a good question. It's got to be animated feature. Seeing Lord and Miller.
Yeah.
I mean, thinking about the last 12, 18 months those guys have had, I mean, even I think it was Phil Lord posted a picture today, which was his Oscar on a mantle next to his Lego Oscar, which you'll remember that he made after they didn't get nominated for Lego Movie a couple of years ago. And you just think about the journey that these guys have had. I mean, being a front runner for an animated feature, then not even getting nominated. Getting a Star Wars film, having the Star Wars film taken away, and then finally getting to stand up on Oscar stage and hold their Oscars up in the air. I mean, they've had a roller coaster of emotions, man, and it was really fulfilling to say, guys, like, it may not have seemed like it for many, many moments, but things worked out the way they were supposed to, and it couldn't have happened to two nicer guys or two more talented guys, and that made me very happy.
Yeah,
I thought that was a great moment, and also just the idea of them winning over the other films that it was nominated for, and, you know, it was cool to see Phil and Chris up there, and I'm glad they got to talk. I'm glad they got to, you know, because I know Phil co-wrote it or wrote it, and then Chris just produced it. Not just produced it, but he wasn't a writer on the film, I believe. And, you know, just see them up there. My favorite moment was easily Sam Jackson announcing Spike Lee, and then Spike Lee with his gold Air Jordans getting off the ground like 10 feet, it looked like, into Sam Jackson's arms. And, you know, just, I think Do the Right Thing is one of the greatest movies ever made, so it was just very cool to have Sam Jackson give him that award. You know,
you saw it on his face as soon as he opened the card and awesome. Read it. You could see how happy he was.
Which sometimes I feel like the Oscars, they pick presenters out of hopes that you get that moment.
Right.
I mean, think of the year that Martin Scorsese won Best Director. The presenters were Spielberg, Lucas, and Coppola. And the hopes that, of course, you hope that it's those three giving it to Scorsese. But if it hadn't been, it would have been kind of an awkward, like, oh, well, like, this is clearly
like with Alfonso.
But it's not. Like, clearly, well, clearly.
Yeah, that's what feeds into what my favorite one was, which was Cuarón. And it's Alfonso getting director because two is special. You know, like, one is amazing and well-deserved. Two puts him in rarefied air. And the most beautiful moment was Guillermo being able to read Alfonso.
I know how to pronounce that name.
Yeah. Oh, my God. My
heart is pounding thinking about it. But, you know, I got to say, I actually thought, for me, very rarely does an Oscar speech, I'd argue, make me look at the world differently. But Alfonso Cuarón's speech for Best Foreign Language Film, where he talked about growing up with foreign films, and those foreign films were Jaws and The Godfather, and this perspective that every film is a foreign language film to someone.
Yeah.
And just a reminder, I thought that was great, because I think we're probably a little bit more open to watching a foreign language film than maybe the average moviegoer. And it was just a reminder to every person out there not to close your mind just because you might have to read subtitles, because every country on this planet delivers high-quality cinema. And sometimes maybe you just don't speak the language that the characters do, but that shouldn't shut you off. And it was really an amazing reminder when he put it like that, that some of our favorite films were, for him, the foreign language films he had growing up. I thought that was just to me, that was personally my favorite speech of the night, because it really made me stop and go, wow, my entire perspective on cinema has changed because of what he just said.
It blew my mind that Jaws was a foreign language movie. Like, that was a very strange thing to hear. And Jake,
but it makes sense.
Jake's 100% right. I've never thought about it, which is why I was so adamant about recommending Roma as much as I possibly could, because I know people would be automatically, some people would be automatically turned off by it being black and white and in subtitles. And that's essentially how Alfonso Cuarón probably watched Jaws with subtitles. So I find it interesting. That actually was Jake's point, that was a mind-blowing perspective. I have never thought of The Godfather being a foreign language movie.
When was the last time an Oscar
movie
speech changed your perspective on movies?
But well, he's a pretty brilliant guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he came on Real Blend. He has to be.
And they cut to, I think they cut to Guillermo del Toro. I don't know if you guys realize, I've watched that speech 3 or 4 times now. Because that moment, I love that moment so much. I'm so happy Jake brought that up.
But that was his foreign language.
Right.
Because he won so many freaking Oscars last night that it was hard to... But that was his foreign language speech, I believe. So Guillermo didn't present that one.
Right. Guillermo was in the crowd. They cut to Guillermo laughing.
I see what you're saying.
So
got it.
I can't remember. There was 2 films he said at first before he got a laugh. Because I think it took a second for everybody to process what he just said. It was Jaws
Was it Rashomon?
Rashomon was the third one. What was the? I have it right here.
You mentioned The Godfather.
I'll get to my point in a second with this. But, here it is, right here. Okay, so it was Citizen Kane, Jaws, Rashomon, Godfather. So he says Citizen Kane, and nobody reacts yet. If you listen to the audio, it wasn't until he hits Jaws that people started processing exactly what he meant, because it was such a brilliant and thought provoking piece of information that I don't think anybody, at least in my mindset, had ever thought about.
Right.
Like, those movies are so American to us. So American, right? Like, they're so... Not Rashomon, but, like... And that was cool that he put that in there, too, because that was Akira Kurosawa, right?
Yeah. So that's a foreign language film to us.
Yeah. And that's even more foreign language to... Like, it's like a double element there for him. Because maybe... I'm assuming he grew up with some English-speaking elements in his lifetime. I don't know. But, you know, it's fascinating to think about. I mean, it truly blows my mind that, like, Die Hard's a foreign language movie. I mean, think about that for a second. Right. So, well, but yeah,
those
but...
Were,
Yeah.
If those are our favorite wins, which ones made you the most disappointed? And again, not yet getting to Best Picture. Not yet getting Best Picture.
Oh, can I say one more thing real quick about Samuel L. Jackson?
Sure.
Jake and I think we all have, interviewed him a million times. I've interviewed Sam Jackson, I think, the most out of any actor I've ever talked to. He is not an excitable type of person. He's very chill. Mm. And he's like very, like, I've brought things up to him about like going to, like, Jake knows this. Every time I go to Cannes, France, or wherever I'm in France for a junket, I always go to McDonald's and get a Royale with cheese. Always do that just because I love Pulp Fiction. I'll tell Sam Jackson that and I'll go, cool, man. Cool. Like, we'll talk about,
about golf. That's all he wants to talk about.
Oh, I know. But like, my point being is that, like, he's done this for so long that it doesn't really blow his mind anymore. I think he gets excited about the work, and I think he loves working, but it's kind of just part of his natural life. These things that we think are mind-blowingly cool are just Sam Jackson's life.
Yeah, yeah.
So to see him elevate into a geek-out mode was, like, surreal to me, because I've never seen him approach that, and I've sat across from him so many times. Maybe it's my questions, I have no idea, but I don't ever see him as somebody who's just like a very outgoing, hilarious interview. You know what I mean? Right. So I don't know. There was something about Jake. I don't know if you agree with me on this. Like, I think he's pretty chill in interviews.
Yeah, I mean, but I you know, that's his, one of his best friends. That would be the equivalent of like getting the chance to give you an Oscar.
Right.
Like, you would see a reaction out of me.
Yeah.
And I would hope that you would leap into my arms.
No, of course I would.
The way that Spike Lee leapt into his.
But it was cool to see Sam Jackson in a movie situation getting excited about a movie scenario.
Well, he let the facade down, right?
Yeah.
Like,
it was just
a reminder that these are human beings too, and we forget that, like, they're friends, and you know, they want to see their friends succeed and do well. And those are the moments that, to your point, those are the moments you remember whenever they stop sort of performing for the cameras and they become human for a second.
What Sean just said is exactly right. Like, I think Sam Jackson is genuinely excited that he's in every one of these movies, Star Wars, MCU, but there is a coolness to him that, like, you know what? I'm Sam Jackson. This is my life.
Sure.
But he broke that, and that was cool to me.
Well,
that's
it would freak me out to see that out of Bruce Willis, who I don't see that in him anymore. I think that spark of living is gone.
I think Bruce Willis just genuinely just, I get a vibe that he's just tired of the business in general. I don't think Sam Jackson's tired of it. I just think he puts on a cool facade, like you said. Bruce Willis, to me, strikes me as somebody who's just kind of over the Hollywood business. I don't know if you agree with that.
And I would love to see him get that excited again, because I miss that aspect of him.
I mean, Spike Lee is, 60 years old? He jumped into a grown man's arms live on stage, leaped out of the... It was unbelievable. Like, that was so...
Well, I have to give credit to one of our guys on staff who came up with what I thought was a great meme and should have gone further. He had a picture of Nick Fury from the first Avengers, and it says, "I'm here to talk to you about the," and he crossed out Avengers Initiative and he put Nick's, because that's such a weird thing for Sam Jackson to do, but so perfect for Spike. Because
I absolutely loved
it. And Spike, by the way, was like a kid again last night. I mean, like, that guy's been making movies for so many years, and I've interviewed him before. Jake has too. He can be a tough interview, a very tough interview. To see him kind of walk into that show last night, like he was like a kid in film school again, and like be blown away by the idea that he was on this stage winning an Oscar. I mean, he was nominated in 1990, right? What year was Do the Right Thing? I don't remember what year that was.
He was not nominated for that.
I think he was nominated for 1990 for something. Well, I don't know if it was Do the Right Thing, but I think...
It was nominated for a picture, but I want to say
it was
he
writer,
got a screenplay nomination.
Right, okay. Screenplay nomination. Okay. I don't know if it was Do the Right Thing, but double check on that. But either way, it was 1990. There you go. Because the movie was 89, 1990 Oscars. But he didn't win. I think another actor in that movie got nominated too. I can't remember the guy's name. I think it might have been
Danny Aiello. It was Danny Aiello.
Yeah, yeah.
Who I think won.
But I don't know. It was just like that, like going back to these, every moment we're mentioning here, it's such a great question that you asked. I'm glad you asked it, because Jake brought up that speech, and I didn't process it until I watched it a couple times. Like what Alfonso said, man. Oh my God, so weird.
Well, come back around to disappointments. I want to get to disappointments. What's a snub or an award that happened that you guys are like, ugh, And again, not pick, we're not getting picture yet.
Yeah, look, I by no means am I like a massive self-confessed Glenn Close fan. And in fact, like I've actually seen her be not a nice person. So there's a part of me that kind of goes,
oh, tell that story.
I was at a restaurant at the Four Seasons one time and just saw her break, just rip apart a server. And as a guy that used to wait tables, I have no patience for that. I have no patience for people that are mean to servers. Be nice to people that handle your food. But you gotta feel anyone that goes 0-7 in anything,
right?
There's a part of you that goes like, because you know, the award season is such a grind. And if you're thinking of, she did everything right. She played ball. She did everything she's supposed to do. And to get that close and still miss out, you know, there's got to be, and granted, I've been making fun of her this whole award season. I think all of her, like, who, me, acceptance speeches have been super insincere. That being said, I don't like to see anyone go for 0-7. I mean, even Amy Adams is getting in that territory, too. She's now 0-6.
The difference with Amy Adams is that we all know
she's still got plenty of time.
Yes, she's going to have multiple opportunities, and Glenn Close
does
not.
But that's the thing: how many more of these amazing Oscar-worthy performances? Because there might be another movie where she is really good, and there might be another movie where she gets an Oscar nomination.
Sure,
but how many more movies is she going to be the front runner again? That's going to be tough.
Did you guys hear about Glenn Close's favorite? Did you guys hear about Glenn Close's favorite Gerard Butler movie? I don't know if you guys heard about this one yet.
Is it Glenn Close Down?
No, it's Glenn of Thieves. It was like a really big movie for her life, and I think she was very excited about that one. So, yeah, Glenn of Thieves. Really, you know, good one.
She should have won for that.
Yeah. Well, she wasn't in it. It's her favorite Gerard Butler movie.
I'm staying in that category for my most disappointing one, and I'm saying Olivia Colman winning because it's category fraud. It's category. Like, she is not a lead
actress.
She's
not leading.
And the only reason she's in that category is that she didn't compete against her other two, and they didn't win. So what's the point? That whole thing was just a shell game.
But why are you guys mad about Olivia Colman, but you're not mad about Mahershala Ali?
Well, it's the same thing.
Mahershala Ali is arguably as much of a lead actor, or actor in a lead role, as Viggo Mortensen is.
The same thing, and it counts against... God, whose name I'm blank? Sam Elliott in the exact same way. How many more chances is Sam Elliott gonna get an opportunity?
Right, but you guys seem fixated on Olivia Colman's position, but not Mahershala Ali.
No, we haven't gotten to Mahershala Ali yet. I think Mahershala Ali is definitely a lead. We've discussed this before a million times in the show. What it comes down to is how the studio positions the actor.
Right. But that being said, the Academy can go against that. If you remember the year that Kate Winslet won the Oscar, they were pushing her for lead for Revolutionary Road
and then
supporting for The Reader. And that was how it was the entire award season before the Academy ended up nominating her for lead actress for The Reader and then just not for Revolutionary Road. They can choose to do it how they want.
I'm going
to
float something based on Mahershala last night. I don't think he's really proud to be part of this movie.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Well, I think he won for Moonlight and he's very proud that he won for Moonlight. And then he won last night and he was very subdued and didn't seem like he was on the Green Book bandwagon.
To get some clarification, the controversy surrounding Green Book throughout the award season, we don't have to get into all of it, but what is so the Don?
We don't have time to get into all of it.
But the Don Shirley aspect of it. So from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I could be wrong, Don Shirley, the family, was not happy with the portrayal of the storyline. Is that correct?
Well, no, I'll tell you, the story is written by the story is written by the son of Viggo Mortensen's characters.
Right.
And he's basing it on the memories of his father, stories that his father told him over the years.
Right.
So they could, like anyone's memories, they're not fact and they're probably, you know, weighted in one direction or the other, and they never but the family of Don Shirley is saying that they were never really consulted to give their side of all of these stories. So, but and in one sense, that's okay. If you're choosing to just, we're going to tell this side of the story because this is the one that we know, you're allowed to do that. That's fine. But then you also have to be prepared for the other person's family to come out and say, well, we don't remember it this way, or this isn't necessarily proven 100% because it's a work of fiction. But the more that it was, no, I'm sorry, not a work of fiction. It's a screenplay, but it's it's not like it's not a documentary.
Keep in mind, it won original screenplay. It's not adapted from a book. Woof. It's not adapted for. I mean, when was the last time a true story wasn't adapted from some sort of well-researched source material?
Yeah, I believe
that
it was like a memoir or something. You know, some book that the father wrote. Yeah. But it
and
was,
in fact,
it was just
in
like
the
Italian
press conference afterward, the Viggo, the son that wrote the screenplay, was asked why he didn't go to the Shirley family. And he essentially alluded to the fact that, like, oh, well, no one really asked me to go do it, or I didn't even really know they were around. Like, he didn't even bother to stop and go, maybe I should.
Yeah.
Maybe I should knock on the door of the other person that I'm writing about.
And it was reported that Mahershala apparently apologized to the family, from what I understand. Is that correct? Or,
yes.
Was that official, or was that someone?
Yes, that happened.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, going back to the Mahershala Ali thing and him being proud of the film, and then also back to Jake's point about the leading. I mean, Mahershala Ali, I mean, it's interesting about that one. That one I actually don't have a major issue with. I think it's more Viggo's movie and how Viggo, they both change each other, but I think it's more Viggo's arc. How much he's changed by Mahershala. But then you can look at it both ways, yes. But with Favorite, I think it's clear that Coleman is supporting. And it's Emma's story. She shows up, and it's her entire story. Queen, she's the queen, so I think it makes sense why you position someone as the lead, because they're playing the centerpiece of the story. But I don't think it's as drastic as Mahershala's. Mahershala's, I feel like you could make an argument he's supporting.
Well,
I don't know.
And I'm going to give... My argument is that I'm not mad that Mahershala won, because I think Mahershala gave an Oscar-worthy performance in the movie. So the fact that he got an Oscar, I'm happy for that. I'm not even mad that Rami won, because I think Rami Malek is the best part of that movie, right? And that category, I would have been happy if Viggo won. I would have been happy if Bradley won. I'm fine with Rami winning. I'm truthfully am. I didn't think Olivia Colman was good. Yeah, I would have been fine with Bale winning. I didn't think Olivia Colman was that good. I don't think she did anything really that stood out to me that I was like, this is an Oscar worthy.
I agree. I think Emma and Rachel Weisz are the performances that stood out to me in The Favorite. Olivia Colman. But I will say this, and Jake, you and I did the junket for that movie. When we were in New York for that, there was that buzz going into that junket that Olivia Colman was going to be the front runner to win the Oscar.
Yeah, and because she was shooting The Crown, so we didn't get to interview Olivia Colman.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember being disappointed, thinking, that's a bummer,
we're
because
not gonna get her.
She's probably going to end up winning Best Actress.
Oh, wow,
and
interesting.
She did. Now, I literally remember sitting in that, talking about that with Jake and going, she's the front runner. It sucks we're not getting her. And then all award season, we're like, oh, that didn't really make a difference, right? Because she's not going to win.
Yeah.
And then she won the BAFTA, which I guess now is something we have to start looking at majorly in indications for the Oscars. Right. But, I mean, I didn't really think about the BAFTAs being that much of an indicator. But, you know, you think about, yeah, it's interesting. Like, most disappointing moment of the night for me, and I guess we'll get to the other aspect of it. But and here's the thing. I think I was having a we were texting about this. I may have changed my tune on this based on what I texted you guys last night about the VFX award for First Man. And like, I was just happy to see First Man win something. So I was just like, okay, whatever. Just somehow give that movie some recognition so Damien's name can get out there. But that movie is so mostly practical. I mean, there's CG in the film that fills in. So I guess you could make an argument that the CG was so seamless that it helped the practical effects
this
come to
life.
This
is exactly my point. When you were celebrating that win last night, your whole point is with the moon landing, that it's all just a giant screen and an actual capsule.
But here's the thing, though. The CG work that goes into a movie, when it's done well, you don't notice it. And if I remember seeing a video of the behind the scenes of how they shot a scene in Wolf of Wall Street when they were on like the boat, and the entire thing was green screened. Mm. You would never have guessed it. So I think a lot of the CG in First Man goes unnoticed because it's complemented by the practical effects. For example, the sequence in the moon at the end, you're using CG to remove the wires from the actors so they can look like they're floating. You know, it seems simple, but maybe that visual effects artwork, that work that goes into that. But here's the thing. I mean, I think we all agree that Avengers Infinity War deserved that award.
I would say, as much as I love a world in which First Man has an Oscar win, that win should have gone to Avengers Infinity
War. I think emotionally last night when we were texting, because I mean, I say things to you guys all the time that when I'm like super charged up, that I'm not going to watch the Oscars. Because, you know, you just get I mean, this...
Oh, I remember you saying you're not going to watch the Oscars.
This stuff is emotional to me. It's very emotional to me. So I feel deeply connected to the film films that I cover, in a sense of, like, they emotionally affect me. But my point being is that, like, I just, First Man was shut out of essentially everything. So when that won, I was just thankful to hear First Man. But looking back on it now, you know, visual effects, you know, I think First Man or Infinity War is clearly the winner there. But
it's,
you know,
the category that made me the most angry.
That, like, was that, weird.
That made me so mad.
It was a strange choice because that movie is so, goes out of its way to be practical, to a point where there's no green screen. They're just projecting images of space outside of these capsules that they've physically built. So it is strange that a movie that was designed to be so practical got a visual effects award.
Our boy Zach Penn was tweeting about Ready Player One, and someone asked him, like, how is this not the front runner for VFX? And he was like, the Manhattan Chase, the Shining sequence. Like, he was listing all these things, and he's like, all pulled off by one of the greatest filmmakers of our generation, but apparently not good enough.
I actually would argue that that racing sequence in the beginning of Ready Player One could have been the winner for that movie. But, I mean, you got to look at how perfect Brolin's performance capture CGI looks. It's unbelievable. And he's a huge character, so it's flawless.
All right, let's get into it. Best Picture winner, 2019, Green Book. To me, it's definitely one of those films where we're going to look back. I can't remember if we've said this on the podcast or if we said it on the text chain, but, you know, we'll see that it won in a King's Speech sort of way, in an artist sort of way.
In a Crash sort of way.
In a Crash sort of way. We will look at the films that it competed against. To me, off the top of my head, it's nowhere near close to Black Klansman, Black Panther, Roma, Stars Born. I'll even say Vice. I like Green Book more than Bohemian Rhapsody. I like it more than The Favorite. Those are the only two that I put it behind.
I think Green Book, out of the bunch, is my least favorite out of all eight of them.
Interesting. See, I don't want to do this thing where I'm waiting it now because it won and I'm disappointed, because no, I don't hate the movie.
We like Green
Book. And that's a thing.
We all like
it. I do want to point that out.
We all like the movie.
I know a lot of people that like Green Book. I know a lot of people that link Green Book's perfectly
it's
fine.
It's good!
But when it comes to people that have a knowledge of movies, and like I said, and I say that because my mom, I took my mom to the screening. She walked out thinking it was one of the best films she's ever seen in her entire life. Like, she, my mom is ecstatic. And a lot of people around my mom's age, what would you call that, like baby boomers,
mm-hmm.
Think that that movie is fantastic. Like, there is an audience for that movie.
It's very good.
But, I mean, but is it the best
no.
movie of the year?
No.
No, it's not. Like, it's like you can throw a stone and find someone that likes Green Book. You got to throw that stone pretty far to find someone that really thinks it's the best film. I mean, do you guys know of any major critic that named it number one?
No,
do you know of anyone that named it number one?
Well, so what it does is instead it satisfies a broad base in the fact that it got People's Choice Awards at Toronto.
Yeah.
Did it win PGA? Is that the one that it won?
Yeah.
It won the PGA.
Yeah, it won PGA. Which also does the same preferential ballot as the Oscars.
Yeah. So
the preferential ballot system needs to be taken away immediately. This system is in place to award a film that is generalized and liked, not necessarily the best movie. Your award is called Best Picture, not middle picture that everyone agrees on. No, I mean essentially that's what's happening here.
Right.
Like the movie, again, we don't know for sure. I mean, every Academy member might have put that at number one. I highly doubt it. I mean, it's my opinion, but think about this for 1 second. That movie won, in my opinion, because of a system that allowed a average film to find a common ground. Would you guys agree?
Yes.
I mean,
I think so.
That is a very strange type of voting system to give the best movie of the year based on a middle ground preferential ballot.
Well, but when it was announced, it struck me as funny. Like, it's the punchline answer to what's wrong with the Oscars as a whole, right? Like, if everyone's like, oh my God, you have really edgy, controversial, challenging movies like Black Klansman and Roma and The Favorite and Vice, which goes after, you know, U.S. politics and all of these places you could go. The punchline is... but we picked Green Book, right?
Yeah, it's essentially it's like going to Italy and eating at Olive Garden.
Yeah, it really is.
It's like,
and I love Olive Garden.
Sure, it's food.
Yeah,
but look what else you got around. Yeah, I love Olive Garden.
Right.
But you wouldn't eat an Olive Garden if you were in Rome. It's the equivalent. See, most of my metaphors, if you can't tell, are Italian food related.
I love Olive Garden.
John Favreau is the cheese pizza of directors. Green Book is the Olive Garden. Yeah, just, but you know, when you have all of these other films to choose from, and granted, Sean, I know you weren't crazy about The Favorite, but you have to admit that The Favorite at least. It requires more of you as a viewer.
Yes,
it brought more to the table, and it shoved all the chips in the middle and said, "Look, maybe you'll hate me, but maybe you'll love me." And I'd much rather hate a movie that just went balls to the wall and just gave it all and gave it a shot. And I'll go, you know what? Not my cup. Like, okay, I didn't hate it, but like Roma, not my thing. Not my thing. I arguably like. Probably enjoyed the process of watching Green Book more than Roma, but I would much rather Roma win Best Picture.
Sure.
Roma is a better representation of what good cinema is, even though I didn't personally connect with it.
Two things, real fast, Sean, real fast. First of all, don't ever hate on Olive Garden ever again, because it's a masterpiece.
I'm not hating on Olive Garden. I'm joking. But if you're in Rome, you're not going to eat at Olive Garden.
I will go there for the salad though, because they have the best salad of all time. I would definitely, if I was in Rome, I'd get
I
pasta
swear to God, if
place.
We do a junket in Rome and you go to Olive Garden, I will never let you eat
there. Dude, I was in Seville, Spain once for a press thing, and I went to Taco Bell because I had to try it. I wanted
but
to try
on
it
brand.
In
that's
Spain.
On brand.
All right, but one other thing I want to say about, you know,
was it different?
Oh yeah, the meat was actually really cool, and it was different in Spain. Yeah, it was good. Even McDonald's. I got a McDonald's every time I go to Paris or France, and I was gonna Royale with cheese.
You're so worldly.
It's funny to me, like when I walk in there with my phone, and I'm like so excited to order a Royale with cheese, and the McDonald's person's like, "What is your problem?"
And I'm normally the guy like hiding in the corner with my hand over my face.
Why are
like,
you
oh,
so
God.
Excited to order a Royale with cheese? And I remember one time,
dude, I promise you, like you're not the first American that's gone into a McDonald's in France
awesome.
And ordered a Royale with cheese.
What point are you trying to make? Make a point. Oh. Kevin has a point.
I don't even know.
He forgot.
Actually, don't remember.
Dave,
let me ask this then. Does the win by Green Book change the way that you guys felt the Academy was progressing, where we had recent winners Shape of Water, Moonlight? We were getting away from what we thought was the traditional safe Academy pick, and then we went right back to ground zero with a safe Academy pick.
It is a reminder. You know, I've made the joke many times that in order for the Academy to change, unfortunately, a lot of the older members are quite literally going to have to die, and this new age of the Academy is going to have to take over. And it's this, to me, Green Book is a reminder that there is a lot of the old traditionalist Academy of voters still left that are voting members, because to me, that's exactly who. I mean, you can't honestly think that like the voting members that are our age all voted for Green Book. To me, it's the people that have been voting members since the 50s and 60s. Those are probably the ones that all voted for Green Book. And maybe we aren't as far along in the progressive Academy as we thought we were going to be.
I have to give props to Sean for probably the greatest tweet I've ever read in my entire life. when Green Book won, he posted the GIF of arguably one of the greatest scenes in cinematic history, of Jeff Daniels in the bathroom in Dumb and Dumber, which to this day I still think is one of my favorite performances of all time. And it was just like, it was funny to see the words like, "This director just won Best Picture." But I mean, listen, I'm all for filmmakers jumping and trying to find new genres. I think it's hilarious. I think it's awesome that the guy who directed that scene was on that stage. I don't think Green Book was the Best Picture, but it is hilarious to me to think that the guy who directed that sequence won Best Picture last night.
All right, before we get completely off the Oscars, I know we do want to talk about the what I think all three of us agree is the best moment from the evening, which is the performance of Shallow. Showstopper. It was everything that I really hoped it was going to be. The music numbers up to that point were disappointing. Bette Midler did nothing for me, and I love that song.
Yeah, just like Mary Poppins Returns.
Jennifer Hudson struggled through that note. She had that one note she had to hold. I think they took the Coen Brothers song and made an awesome song into a terrible performance.
I actually agree with you on that. I really like that song. Why did they just let Tim Blake Nelson sing that?
I don't know. I don't understand that.
It was awful. Yeah,
it was such a bad rendition of that song.
I'm with you. Can Tim Blake Nelson and Emily Blunt, like, do they not want to sing live? Is that what happened there?
And also, do we know why they didn't perform the Black Panther song?
I guess just because Kendrick Lamar didn't.
He was in a European tour.
Like, why didn't someone else?
All the other songs aside from Shallow had someone else sing it.
Nobody can replicate Kendrick. It's not possible. Kendrick Lamar is one of the greatest musicians of all time, and I don't think anybody could ever stand in for him. I really don't. I mean, I don't think that type of artistry is matched in another person.
But do you think I get what you're saying, but do you think that that is why the Academy made that decision?
Oh, no. I genuinely was reading online, and I don't want to be factually wrong here. I believe Kendrick was on a European tour, and I can double check that, but I mean...
But do you believe that they made the decision not to just not have that song, period, because they thought, well, no one else can do it?
That's my thought process on it. I mean, listen, and we had those two random singers doing Tim Blake Nelson's song, but I think Badly. That's, yeah, but I mean, I do, yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody can do what Kendrick does. The guy is a mastermind. I mean,
I don't disagree with you, and whoever went up there and tried to attempt that song, you're right, probably would have butchered it.
Yeah.
But it didn't stop all the other songs from being butchered by...
But the Mary Poppins song isn't as, it wasn't a big hit like that song was. Yeah. Like, that was a gigantic song, and it was like, you know, I don't know who else could do that song besides him. I really don't.
Did you guys love Shallow? Did you think it lived up to its billing?
Loved it.
It was unbelievable.
Did you think they were gonna kiss? I thought they were gonna kiss.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I really did too.
And I kind of wanted them to.
Yeah, everyone did.
The way that was shot was so incredible.
You're right.
It was so intimate. And I remember, like, I've told this in the podcast before. What was brilliant about Star is Born, oh my God, by the way, I gotta mention this. If you have not gotten a Star is Born Blu-ray yet, there's a making of featurette on there that is, in my opinion, every Academy Award member should have watched before voting. Because that right there was the reason why that film was Best Picture. Everything about what that went into that, I mean, Bradley Cooper wrote Black Eyes, the song he opens this movie with, like a couple days before doing that. And they went out on stage, and he only had a 10-minute window to shoot it. That's all he had. He had to do it in 10 minutes. And then he had to do Glastonbury in 4 minutes. One time. Like, you only have literally 4 minutes to get this take right, and that's your shot in the movie.
Right.
So under that pressure is mind-blowing. But back to the Shallow performance, I mean, Cooper's talked a lot about this and being on stage behind Lars Ulrich, who's the drummer from Metallica, and learning about the perspective of an artist on a stage looking out at a crowd. And that's how he wanted to shoot A Star is Born. That was like, what a brilliant... I saw someone tweet that this was like the alternate ending to Star is Born. Like, they were like... It was almost like they were in their own world. You didn't even know... Like, the audience were like just like... They were just like shadows.
Yeah,
that's why I'm saying.
Gabe texted us and pointed out something really interesting, is that during so many of the Oscar performances, a camera will cut to a celebrity in the crowd to get their reaction. And the lighting, as Gabe pointed out, was such that it was almost as if they were the only ones in the room. Yeah. You know, they never cut to another person's face, though I would love to see Bradley Cooper's girlfriend's face during that performance, but it never cut to anyone else. You could, aside from maybe a few people that you could tell who it was in the front row, you couldn't really tell who any of it was just like it was a faceless audience, and it was like they were the only two people on the planet. I thought that was perfect, absolutely perfect.
And it was perfect for the Oscars because it was shot so cinematically. And I would assume it was done on a Steadicam. But I was saying this earlier in the podcast about the hostless show. I thought it was so brilliant that they just literally went right into it. There was no introduction. There was no, like, you saw the behind the scenes people rolling out the piano, and they just walk on stage together gracefully. And there's something so beautiful about the intimacy of that performance. It was being seen by I guess, billions. I don't know how many people watch the Oscars around the world.
It was the moment everybody was waiting for. Truthfully.
Yeah.
And he
sounded great. And here's the thing about Bradley Cooper. Another reason why he deserved Best Actor and Director. He's not a singer. The guy's not a singer or a musician. He's an actor who learned these skills to make a movie. And now
which
he's
is why when you said Rami's clip was weird when they showed it, because it, to me, I was like, oh, well, you're just lip syncing. I forgot you're just lip syncing. You're not singing this.
Like, why would they pick that clip?
Terrible.
Like, there were clips in which he actually acted well in the movie. Why would you pick a clip in which we all know you're not actually singing?
I was surprised I rewatched Bohemian over the weekend because Lauren and I were just kind of putting on movies in the background because we were just home all weekend. I'm surprised they didn't use the fruit fly sequence. There's a sequence where he goes out into the rain after Lucy Boynton's character gets into a cab and drives away, and then the guy from Downton Abbey walks out to the house to tell Freddie to come back in, and he goes, why didn't you tell me about Live Aid? And then he says, you know when something's gone rotten, and he goes, the fruit flies that go to the rotten food, it's like raining, it's like a beautiful performance. I mean, or that or the Live Aid sequence. The Live Aid sequence, just show some of that. I mean, when he's dancing around on stage. But that dialogue he has about the fruit flies was, I'll never forget that. It was a very powerful sequence.
Would have been a good clip. All right. So that was our recap. Do you have anything else you want to weigh in about the telecast? Or? Good. Then let's shift over to this week's Real Blend game, which was featuring someone who won. Oh, gosh. No, wait. I totally forgot. We have a bet we have to settle.
Gabe,
are you going to talk? Is this going to be Gabe's first time talking on the show? Come on, Gabe, talk on the
Gabe.
Show. This
People
is your
wanna
moment.
Hear the
you
melodious
can reveal
timbre
who wins
of your voice.
The burger competition. All right, so for people who might not have listened last week, we bet that... So we all gave our picks. We decided that if whoever gets the most amount wins and whoever gets the least amount loses, the loser has to pay for a meal at the winner's burger place of choice. Kevin's is In-N-Out. Jake's is Whataburger. Mine is Shake Shack.
Hey, watch it. You might be eating Whataburger very soon.
Gabe says going to drop the winner.
First message
us
the loser.
We have a clear cut. We have a clear cut winner and a clear cut loser. That's correct. We have no ties, Gabe.
Because the loser pays and then the winner picks and then the middle person just exists.
Middle person just enjoys. All right, he says he's going to drop it in here. So I'm looking at the chat.
Oh, you don't know yet.
I don't know.
What is Gabe giving you now?
Know.
The winner or the loser?
He says the winner is, but I don't want the winner. I want the loser. Oh, or no, do we want to know where we're going first? We want to know where we're going. Okay, so the winner is. No, now he says the loser is. The winner is.
Damn it, Gabe!
Okay, here he goes again. Hold on, he's typing.
I feel like I'm watching the Best Picture announcement again.
Yeah.
No, it is not. It is not. It's a three-way tie.
No, it's not. That's not possible.
No. No.
How's that possible?
Are you kidding me?
No, we disagreed on enough categories.
All got 12.
Wow.
You all got 12 categories.
What?
All right, so we'll just go ahead and announce. It's the best one.
That is the most on-brand thing that Real Blend has ever done.
Oh, my God.
All three of us got 12.
That is the equivalent of Green Book winning Best Picture.
We clearly, clearly have to break this tie. What are we going to do?
I don't know. How do we break the tie?
All right, I have it. Captain Marvel box office.
Okay.
Right now, based on what we know about the movie, possible tracking, whatever information you have.
Opening weekend?
Does Captain Marvel open over $100 million?
Oh, we're just saying yes or no, or we're giving our number?
Oh, it's
I feel like we have to give a number, right?
We give a number.
It is a little harder than I thought. All right, let's do something different then.
All right, we will settle this next week, because now we're stuck in a tie.
All right, so why don't we ask our listeners?
Okay.
So why don't our listeners, who are listening to this podcast, tell us how we should break our tie?
It needs
to be some type of... thing that we can tally, like something that we can gauge who's gotten more right or not.
I like that. All right. We want suggestions either on the Real Blend Twitter or email us at realblend@cinemablend.com.
How did we
three-way tie? Are you freaking kidding
me? That's the most disappointing thing. I'm so disappointed in each of you. How did this happen? How did you let this happen?
I thought I was definitely going to lose. I thought I was like...
I thought it was going to be close, but I thought it would come down... Because we disagreed, what, on screenplay? And then we disagreed on a couple of the sound ones? I mean, like, I know we didn't disagree on much.
I picked Terrence Blanchard for score. But I thought that there were enough. And I didn't get that. I didn't get VFX. Oh, well, none of us got VFX, I guess. Gabe's solution that each of us has to buy burgers at each spot.
By the way, so I do want to, you mentioned score. I want to give a shout out. I thought Ludwig's score was awesome. His speech was awesome. That was a cool moment when he got up there.
That was a nice
moment. I didn't realize that him and Ryan met at USC and they were like doing short films together. And I mean, think about that for 1 second. 12 years ago, those guys were at USC making movies together.
It's amazing.
And now they've made, I think Ludwig did Fruitvale and Creed with Ryan. I could be wrong, but... Man, imagine being on that stage and looking over at your friend who was your college roommate or whatever, right, and going, we're at the Oscars.
Yeah, winning.
And by the way, there was a great tweet today that blew my mind that was so accurate. And this is the only thing that made me mad about last night's show. Why couldn't a camera find Ryan Coogler? They kept saying his name over and over again in speeches, and the camera could never find where he was. Eventually, it found him.
Oh, really?
And showed him in the crowd. Until they finally found him, and this is based on someone's tweet that I saw that it completely reminded me of how I felt. They kept saying Ryan Coogler, and they kept looking in a direction, any winner who was up there, and they never would cut to Ryan Coogler.
I wonder
and
if he was never in his seat. Maybe he was just up, moving around.
I mean, I was like, why is Ryan not here? Because I remember an interview with Kevin Feige.
Or that Oscars cameraman have no idea what Ryan Coogler looks like.
Well, Kevin Feige said in a podcast that I saw in an article that if Black Panther had won Best Picture, that Coogler would be on stage to accept the award, that he would be the one that would give the speech. Mm-hmm. So that's why I figured he was definitely there. But for a lot of the night, until they finally showed him, I didn't think Ryan Coogler was in the audience.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's weird.
All right. We have to quick do This Week in Movies, and there's only three. And did you guys see Greta?
No.
Did you guys see Climax?
No.
Jake, you saw Tyler Perry. You saw Tyler Perry. How is it?
I don't think that... Jake, be careful on that, because I think Lionsgate has really weird embargoes.
Yeah, it's an opening day embargo.
His movie specifically. Yeah, yeah,
Oh, it's an opening day embargo? All right.
Yes.
All right, that's his week in movies.
I asked Tyler Perry about that question one time because he doesn't allow, I believe, I don't know if it's still the same thing, he no longer screens his films to critics. And I can't remember, I asked him why, and I said, I'm a critic and I want to review your movie. Why can't you let me see your film to review it? And I'll have to find the answer, but it was something along the lines of there's a lot of hatred towards my films, and essentially it was something about the audience and the critics.
Didn't he also say something like that?
He's a really tough interview.
He's a businessman.
Just because his answers are very short, he's very succinct.
I always prepare more questions than I normally do.
He's smart.
He's a smart guy, and the guy is. I mean, listen, he's actually been in some good movies. Like his role in Gone Girl was great. I mean, he's done some good stuff.
He's Colin Powell in Vice.
Yeah, that was cool too. But I mean, I just feel like these Madea movies. There are some of them I kind of like, the first couple ones, but I mean, yeah, I mean, I haven't.
But
seen
he doesn't.
One.
He fascinates me in an interview because he never gives you any more than just the answer to the question that you asked.
Right.
That's it.
I mean, he gives sound bites.
Yeah.
Yeah, I give him that.
That's amazing.
Like
right.
he is the easiest person to edit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very true. All right. This week's blend game. We are playing Spike Lee blend, which I think is appropriate, given coming off the fact that Spike won his first Oscar, seemed to be having the absolute most fun at last night's ceremony more than anybody else, especially after he won. This morning, I thoroughly enjoyed watching Spike giving his behind the scenes interviews.
Did you see the one on the BBC?
Yes.
Yes.
Fantastic.
That's my cup of tea.
Oh my God. These two British guys.
My favorite thing that he does is he tells a joke and then he runs away.
Yeah. I do that.
Like he's being interviewed. This is for people who haven't seen this. He's being interviewed by, it looked like the BBC, I believe.
Yeah.
And this guy goes, the question was something along the lines of, why were you so offended by Green Book? Was that the question? Something along those lines.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Spike goes, oh, offended. Are you British? You're British? Yeah. All right, let me answer this in a British way. And he goes, it wasn't my cup of tea. Now, the line itself was clever, But then he literally ran off like a 12-year-old kid. It was hilarious.
Died laughing.
It was awesome. Like, it
well,
made
and
me-
you know what? He handled it so well because it's not a good look for him to criticize another film. It's not. But he's also not changing his tune. He's not going to be like, no, I respect it. Or he's not doing that either. He's finding a very clever way out of saying nice things about Green Book, which I think is fantastic. So
yeah, I mean, it's an interesting balance. The thing he did during the show, reportedly, that to me was disrespectful. But like an interview like that, that's funny to me. Reportedly, from the tweet that I saw, and I don't know if this has been confirmed, is that he got up out of his seat after they announced Green Book and tried to leave. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then apparently he was
You can see him.
He was
you can
stopped
see him
from
get
leaving.
Up and leave.
And I sent you guys. There was a lot of things that kind of happened off camera. I sent you guys a video before the show today. Rami Malek fell off stage at the end of the show, like hurt himself. Like it is a wild video. Like you see his head walking, and then you see him no more. Like he just
and you hear it,
and you hear it. And Alfonso Cuarón turns around. I hope he's okay. I mean, that was like a weird, really weird moment. I don't understand what happened.
All right, Spike Lee blend. Jake, I'm told you get to go first.
You know, one of the things that I love about Spike Lee is that he gives slices of life from different places, from different people, and from different times that I am not super familiar with. And he, you know, I always, whether I like his movies or not, and I don't always, I walk away from his films feeling like I know more about a time and a place and a group of people that I didn't know before. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit more aware of something. And the one that is my favorite of his, I'm not saying best, but is my favorite, is 25th Hour.
Mm-hmm.
This very simple story of a man who knows that he's got 24 hours left before, he's got one day before he has to check into prison. And he's got all of these sort of loose ends that he's got to tie up. And it's a simple story in and of itself. And even that itself kind of sounds interesting. But then it's also a slice of life of New York in the months after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And this very sort of tense feeling that everyone, you know, after the rah-rah of patriotism kind of faded away, there was sort of this kind of this deep-seated tension that I would imagine, having not been to New York until many years after 9/11, I would imagine was there and was deep-rooted in a lot of people. And just everything about that movie, I think it's one of his sharpest screenplays, a collection of performances from Edward Norton, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Rosario Dawson, Barry Pepper. Really just it's an incredible ensemble piece and features one of the most haunting, horrific, powerful monologues of any movie in recent memory, which is Edward Norton just staring into the mirror, just going off on every group of people imaginable. It is my favorite Spike Lee movie because I felt like I walked away just most impacted and really having my eyes open to a slice of life in a time of which I didn't really realize that was a time I really super needed to know about.
Yeah, that's a great choice, man. Like all of Spike's films, but more so, there's like a handful of them that are deeply personal to him. That you just know that he's absorbing stuff that's going on in his day-to-day life, you know, and putting it into a camera at the right time. And it's one of the things I talked about with Black Klansman and how he makes it so contemporary, even though it's set in the 70s, is that you can almost miss your window, you know, when you try to put so many messages into it because the political climate can change or what's relevant in the headlines can shift away. But with 25th Hour, he really did tap into that post 9/11. It's like a frustration, you know, it like weighs on people like a blanket of just like, now we're in this post 9/11 era and we're just not gonna be able to shake it right away. And it definitely affected those guys in that movie. It's very true. Great choice. I go next and I picked He Got Game for a couple different reasons. The aspect of Spike that I connect with more on any other level is his love of basketball. I'm a huge, huge basketball fan. Basketball is a religion in the Carolinas. My boys play basketball. I'm a diehard NBA fan. I'm a diehard college basketball fan. And I love how much Spike loves basketball. And he's done some great sports documentaries around basketball teams, history of basketball. And then, of course, this movie, He Got Game. The first time I interviewed Spike was for The Miracle of St. Anna. And I was so freaking nervous to sit across from him. Like, it's just, it's Spike Lee.
And he's an intimidating guy.
I was so overly prepared, and I sat down and I said, hey, I'm from the NBC affiliate in Charlotte, North Carolina. And he goes, man, what is Jordan doing with the Bobcats? And I was like, what are you talking? I did not expect basketball questions from him at all. And he was like, you guys have not been able to build a team yet. You're stuck in the, you can't even get into the eighth seed. And he just like went right into it. And I was, and I could talk basketball forever. So we did for the longest time. And then, he just kept asking me questions. Like whenever we would get to the end of the next question, he'd be like, yeah, but why did you trade this guy? And how come we not, why isn't this guy getting more playing time? And then, the people around him were freaking out because it was at TIFF and it was clearly a tight day. And then Spike said, give him more time. Yeah, I need, he needs to have more time.
Yes.
Because I took up all of his time talking to him about Jordan and the Bobcats. And so I was like,
love that story. I love stories like that.
It was great. It was really great. And the other reason why I love He Got Game is I think it's infused with Spike's love of basketball, but I love Sleazy Denzel. Sleazy Denzel is so cool to watch. I think he just enjoys playing those aspects more so than he wants to be the traditional hero, you know, on screen. And to be the dad who has to sort of corrupt his young son, played by a young Ray Allen, who is incredible in his prime, to go play ball so that he can get a shorter prison sentence is, again, I think it's subject matter that Spike really loves. And he's kind of surprised he gets to play around in it, you know, and it creates to me a really passionate film. And whenever people talk about Spike Lee, they're like, oh, he's just angry and opinionated. No, he's not. You know, he can quite often pull off these really entertaining crowd play. Inside Man is another one like that, that he's not always this on a soapbox preaching at people. He's just a gifted storyteller. And He Got Game is one that I go back to often, so that's why I picked that.
That's a great pick. Also, yeah. A great pick.
Cool.
Also
all great, great choices. I mean, like that's the thing about Spike Lee is that there's so many you can go to. I mean, and everybody has a very personal attachment to his movies for sure.
Kevin?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like, you know, my mind is a bit more cliche because I guess it's the one that you would expect people to go to for Spike Lee because it's a masterpiece, but it is Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
But I have a very personal connection to that film because I was in college. I hadn't seen the film at that time. It was like 2001 or two. I'm sorry. It was 2004, 2005. I took a class, an English class called COM 332 or English 332. And every week you would go to like the Johnson Center Cinema at George Mason University and you would sit in this little theater and you'd watch a film and then you would spend a week dissecting it. And one of them was Do the Right Thing. Citizen Kane was another one. But Do the Right Thing was something that stuck out to me because of the way it was shot. Also, it's scary relevant, extremely relevant. Like timeless. Like that movie is now. I mean, there are elements of that movie that are right now. And it's like very strange to watch it over and over again because as the political climate changes throughout the years, that movie changes with it. So what I mean by that is you watch the film in whatever climate you're in and you find things that are relevant and the movie kind of grows. It becomes more. And I find that interesting that a movie can do that when it's sitting there on a disc. The movie's done. It's edited. Yeah. It's printed. It's done. But it's not done. So to have a movie actually live, like continue to grow,
right,
from 1989 to now. I mean, the movie's what? Is it 20? No, 30. 30 years now. 30 year anniversaries this year. Wow. So it's interesting because in dissecting that film, it's his shot choices that blew my mind. It's a very beautifully photographed movie in regards to the way it's shot. You feel the heat of that summer. Like, I
get hot watching that movie.
Man, when they're in the apartment, there's so many scenes in that film, and I say this a lot about movies, I find myself wanting something to change. I hope something different happens. Like, I hope Radio Raheem does not die.
Right.
And that sequence, I hope that someone's going to somehow step in and go, guys, just stop. I mean, this is, you know, it's such a powerful thing to be immersed in a storyline so much that you forget and kind of hope the disc will change, that something will happen with the movie that you don't expect. And then the fight, the power song, Public Enemy, what an anthem. That song is just, that song is the movie. Going with what Jake was saying about the monologue that Edward Norton has in front of the mirror, that movie has a great moment like that, with multiple characters looking essentially right into the camera, mm-hmm. saying exactly what you're talking about. I think the thing they do in Do the Right Thing is they have certain groups of people talk about other groups of people, very similarly to kind of what Edward does in the mirror. But it's one person in Plymouth Hour. But it is, oh my God, that film is, I don't understand how that was was that his first movie?
No, he did She's Gotta Have It.
Okay, so.
School Days, I think, was before.
Was School Days before that?
When did he do Mo Better Blues?
Mo Better Blues was after.
See, my first Spike Lee movie was Do the Right Thing. I know, technically speaking, I would have already seen some of his other work, like He Got Game and things like that, outside before I went to college. But
She's Gotta Have It was 86, School Days was 88,
and that was
Do
89.
The Right Thing was 89, and then Mo Better Blues was 90, and then Jungle Fever, 91.
So
and then
it's
Malcolm X, 92. Good Lord, Spike has great movies.
It's his third film. So, I mean, there's something about that movie, like I said, that just continues to grow, and just like, I mean, there's the little things about it. Like, I think there's nothing more intense than a sequence when a guy's shoe gets scuffed. Like, I mean, I'm like, remember the character? Like, I mean, like, that is not a normal tension sequence that you would have in a movie that you'd be on the edge of your seat about. But like, that scene makes me, it's an intense sequence. And there's something weird about that film in the sense of tonal. Like the way it shifts tones, there's so much comedy in that movie. Then there's like so much relevant elements of racism and things like that. So it just I don't know. There's something about the way that film is structured, shot, photographed, scored, soundtrack, I mean, everything about it. And then Spike is telling us the story. Spike, it's interesting. Spike's directing it and also leading us through it physically on screen, which is interesting to me. So there's a lot to be said about that movie that I could just go on forever about. But I remember dissecting it very carefully in school and it leaving a major mark on me. And that's my favorite movie of his, and also I think his best film to date. And I think Black Klansman was, in my opinion, brought me back to that excitement level that I had with Spike at that time.
Yeah,
that's why I loved it so much.
I think Black Klansman will be another movie that, even though it's done on the disc, it's going to change. It'll change it, you know, for years to come also. I agree with that 100%. Matt Positano agrees with Kevin, says Do the Right Thing. Kyle David Perry said Inside Man. And Robert Shivery, longtime listener, went with Black K Klansman, which I'm going to be able to say for the last time this award season. Black K Klansman. Oscar winner, Black K Klansman. For next week, you can reach out on Twitter and play along with the next blend game, or you can also let us know your picks via email at realblend@cinemablend.com. But in honor of our good friend and patron saint, Alfonso Cuarón, winning an Oscar, and in honor of the fact that the Academy decided they were going to backtrack and actually announce cinematography on the show, we are going to play hashtag Chivo Blend and celebrate the films of Emmanuel Lubezki. So
that is...
Start kicking those around, kids. Hashtag Chivo Blend.
I love one when you name one and I don't automatically know what my answer is going to be.
Yeah.
One's gonna take some time. I mean, I have like three or four floating in my mind right now.
Right.
And when we get to that episode, Jake and I have to tell a funny story about like literally staying up as late as we could to go to a party to stalk him, to like meet him.
And we did.
Yeah.
Well, and I framed the restraining order. Yeah. We'll talk about it.
At one point, we had Alejandro Iñárritu's daughter help us.
Essentially saying, for the love of God, would you talk to these guys?
Help us. And meanwhile, DiCaprio's in the corner over there, and we're all just like,
couldn't care less.
We just want to meet Chivo.
We call that a tease. All right. Listeners can follow us online. Jake is at Jake's Takes. Kevin is at Kevin McCarthy TV. I'm at Sean_O'Connell. Of course, we have the Real Blend Twitter feed that our community is using and growing by the day. at Real Blend on Twitter. Go over to the iTunes, drop us a review. As you saw, we will read it at the top of the show. If you are not on iTunes and listen to us through some other sort of podcast means, you can also email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. We have a couple of events coming up that we're going to be able to start talking about, but I can't talk about them just yet. Although one is coming up sooner rather than later, so pay attention to the Twitter feed. We'll be back next week for episode number 59. Is that right? Yes. So, and hopefully if you guys have solutions to how we can break the three-way tie for the Oscars blend, send us your suggestions. We absolutely need
them too. Cage match.
In the meantime, as always, Blenders, thank you so much for listening, and
done!
Sorry. Kirk. I was completing a burp. Dunkirk.
Thank you.
I hate this show.